Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn. On this February 26, 2011, checking you for the next 60 minutes as we discuss the world of sports. 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number. Of course, you can hit me up on Twitter at twitter.com/WilliamGerald or Blog Talk Radio, facebook.com/Cyril Quinn. Busy, a lot going on in the world of sports. It's a busy weekend, especially in the college basketball ranks, where it is becoming, you know, elimination time as far as these postseason bids are concerned. You have a lot of teams out there who are squarely on the bubble, who are clearly on the bubble. And to me, this begins a three-week process in terms of, you know, basically teams are, you know, have 3 weeks to get their stuff together in terms of polishing their resumes for the NCAA tournament. Have this week, next week being the last week of the NCAA tournament, of the regular season, and then the following week that will conclude championship week and many of the conference tournaments. And, of course, that was Selection Sunday. Selection Sunday will be 2 weeks from today or from tomorrow. So now, you know, we're certainly down to the nitty-gritty. And you look at some teams, you know, looking at a couple teams who had high hopes coming into this year, but are really struggling right now. My focus turns to two teams, these particular teams, in terms of Michigan State and Kansas State. Michigan State, we all know the story, preseason number two, coming off a Final Four appearance, has really underachieved, to say the least. It has some internal problems. Had a kid get kicked off the team. I believe it was Corey Lucius. Got kicked off the team earlier on, but have played better of late and won 3 out of 4. Right now, find themselves at 16 and 11 overall, 8 and 7 in the Big 12, in the Big 10, with a RPI of 37, depending on who you listen to. I mean, CBS.com, ESPN. Well, a relatively decent RPI in a tough conference, and they have a respectable name, a highly regarded name. So they have a couple things going for them. I think this game, and it's hard for me to say a must win, because if they go out there and run the table in the Big Ten tournament, then they will get in as an automatic bid. But the game coming up tomorrow against Purdue, which comes in high as can be, ranked number 8 in the country, I think if they can win that game down in Lansing, that they can basically, in my eyes, clinch a berth to the tournament. Again, this is Michigan State. They notoriously are strong finishers. They're going to get the benefit of the doubt by the committee. Like if they are on the borderline, the committee will put them in. Power conferences always get the benefit of the doubt, especially if you're a Tom Izzo on that level in terms of being a coach and in terms of where he's at as a coach. But a very important game tomorrow in the against the Purdue Boilermakers. The other team that is badly underachieved that needs a win in the worst way is Kansas State. Kansas State came in ranked again top 5 preseason. You know, coming off a great season last year, they've picked it up of late, played a little bit better, had a great win a couple of weeks ago, maybe a week and a half ago against Kansas at home. But that's really been their only big-time win of the season. They really struggled. They have an RPI around 28, 26, playing in the Big 12 conference. They need a win. They need regular season wins. They need to basically run the table until they get to the Big 12 and maybe even win a couple games in the Big 12 tournament. I don't see them winning the Big 12 tournament with the likes of Kansas and Texas being in there. So to me, they're going to have a strong finish their regular season. And unlike Michigan State, I feel like they need to run the table in order to get in. Look at the ACC with a couple of their bubble teams. You know, you have Clemson, Maryland, and Boston College all need wins. You know, North Carolina and Duke are locks to get in. Virginia Tech is a, you know, borderline lock. They're more likely to get in. But you know, you look at Maryland, is at 7-7 in the conference. Clemson is at 7-6. Boston College is at 6-7. Maryland travels to North Carolina tomorrow. Yours truly will be following that game closely. Clemson hosts Wake Forest, and Boston College is at Virginia. All three of those teams need wins. The ACC is a shell of what it once was as a conference. You're gonna have to earn your way to get in. You know, when 10 or 15 years ago, you would get the benefit of the doubt even if your name wasn't Duke or North Carolina. That is no longer the case. I mean, these other teams, the Maryland's of the world, the BC's of the world, and let me correct myself, Florida State is also a virtual lock. As a matter of fact, I'll put Florida State ahead of Virginia Tech as being a lock. So I think, you know, Duke, North Carolina, Florida State, and Virginia Tech in that order, and the ACC probably will get one more out of this group will get in. So I think Maryland, Clemson, and Boston College are fighting for one spot. So I think five will get in out of the ACC. So keep your eyes on that. If you're a big ACC fan. The question for me in this whole going into as we hit get ready for the NCAA tournament championship week coming up is how many teams will come out of the Big East. Now I've heard anywhere from 9 to even possibly 11. Right now, I see that there's absolutely 9 locks. I mean, there are 9 teams that are definitely going to get in without question. Marquette, West Virginia are trying to join those other teams. Again, to me, Marquette, one of those teams is going to get in. I don't think they'll get in 11. I do think that the Big East will get in 10. The conference has been, again, by far and away the best conference in the country. It's not even close. I mean, watching Big East basketball compared to watching the other basketball around the nation is like watching JV versus varsity. And with all due respect to the other teams around the country, that's how good the Big East is. Now, will this pay off in the NCAA tournament? That remains to be seen. I mean, last year the Big East was dominant as well. Then you looked up and got to the Final Four. Got to the Final Four. It didn't, you had just West Virginia, just one Big East team there. So, you know, who knows how that will correlate going into the tournament. But regular season-wise, there's no comparison with the Big East and these other conferences. Every game is like seemingly like a playoff game, so to speak, like a tournament game. The intensity level, you know, you saw Syracuse have a great bounce back win against Villanova, and this week at Villanova. And that's the thing; these teams in the Big East win on the road. You know, you see a lot of these teams in these conferences, Kansas State against Kansas. You see a lot of teams going to take care of home court with the big upsets. In the Big East, teams win everywhere. I mean, Louisville goes to Connecticut. You know, Villanova and Syracuse went on each other's home floor. We see Georgetown went at Villanova and went at Syracuse, and they will play today. Georgetown will host Syracuse at noon in about an hour and a half or so. So, again, we're getting down to that, those last couple of weeks where certainly the committee is paying very close attention to what these teams are doing. Again, this year to me will be no different than the other years as far as it will be dominated by the power conferences because the power conferences go out there and play, you know, the tougher schedules. They play, you know, they're going to get the benefit of the doubt from that standpoint. 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number. Just getting started here on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. Got a lot to do. Coming up, I'll have Saturday morning headlines, do some react quotes, and we'll look ahead towards the NL West. Can the San Francisco Giants repeat last year's magic? We have that and much, much more Ciro Quinn on this edition, latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Minutes after the 10 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn, taking you to 11:30 on this 26th of February 2011. Saturday morning headlines. NFL agent says talks will go until September. They are meeting right now. Of course, you have everybody in the NFL that's of any importance down at the NFL combines. You know, all the agents, Goodell, the NFL Players Association, and somewhere, and they still, of course, they are, the Players Association is meeting with the owners, and they're going through these mediations, and they're trying to negotiate the meetings but quietly. You haven't heard any negotiating through the media lately, so which is a good thing, but. In that, during those meetings, somewhere an agent anonymously came out and said that he doesn't believe the talks will go until at least September. I don't know how much stock you want to put into that. Again, some of these agents that are down here are some of the power brokers like a Tom Condon, and Joe Siegel, Drew Rosenhaus. So, I'm sure that if you're the NFL on both sides, you don't like to hear something like this come out, considering that these agents are not a part of the negotiations. They're not in the same room as, negotiating with Goodell and DeMarcus Smith. One thing that has become evident is that, you have this March 4th deadline coming up next week, March 3rd, 11:59, March 3rd. Before the NFL calendar, before the NFL offseason officially begins in terms of the new calendar year, in terms of the business aspect of the NFL, free agencies will start the whole nine yards. That, you would be shocked if any deal was cut before next Friday. I think it is safe to say that that's not going to happen. Again, nobody knows how long this thing is going to take. From what you've heard, and again, they try to keep quiet this year because the mediator has recommended it. But from what you've heard from all the reports, it sounds like little to no progress has been made. And again, one of the agents basically came out and expressed that in terms of what's been going on through in these meetings. And it's really, I wouldn't start to panic until. I would say, even getting past the draft, I would say if we got into June and there was no action and there was no progress, then you would start to get a little bit nervous. It's no big deal, March, even with the draft, it's no real big deal. But when you start getting into June and you start getting closer to training camp, that's when it's time to get a little bit nervous, and you might have to wonder whether or not there's going to be an NFL season come 2011. you know, they go to September. I mean, forget about it. I mean, September, we're talking about, you know, how many games will be played or if any games will be played at all. So I would not be in panic mode if I were a fan of the NFL. Major League Baseball gave the New York Mets last November a loan, or last fall, I should say, a loan of $25 million to cover operating expenses. And, again, when it rains, it pours for the New York Mets. Of course, you've heard, unless you've been under a rock somewhere, that what the Mets are going through with the whole Bernie Madoff Ponzi scheme and the connection allegedly with, you know, that Saul Katz and Fred Wilpon, you know, that's still under investigation. Now it comes out that Bud Selig had to, you know, that he had to basically take out a loan to help the Mets make it through last season from a financial standpoint. And, you know, some other stuff came out that the Mets are allegedly in $400 million in terms of $400 million of debt in terms of the team. You have Katz and Wilpon trying to sell 25% of the team. To show you how bad a shape the Mets are in financially, the Mets are allegedly worth $858 million. Have $140 million payroll. And you have owners trying to sell off parts of a team. You know, if you're one of the top grossing teams in baseball, which the Mets are in terms of their worth, and you have one of the highest payrolls in baseball, which the Mets do, you know, why are you trying to sell the team? Why would you be trying to sell that if you weren't in just awful financial shape? And to me, it begs two questions as a Mets fan, and I'm sure Mets fans in New York are talking about this right now, is how long can Katz and Wilpon hold on to the team? One. And two, what would a Mets be able to do, you know, trading deadline or just to sign anybody, in terms of free agency? They do have $140 million payroll. How is, are they going to start cutting payroll? Is this going to be a situation similar to the L.A. Dodgers with the McCourts, where they basically are kind of in limbo in terms of what they can do spending-wise? You really don't know at this point. You're going to have to see how it plays out over the course of the season as we get into the regular season and get closer to, say, you know, the trading deadline when teams are either buyers or sellers. So, again, a lot of just – you know, it can't be any worse to be a Mets fan right now. The team on the field stinks, and off the field they're not doing much better either. So we'll see how that goes. The seven Detroit Pistons skipped out last night on practice. Here are some of the excuses they had on why they missed practice. Again, you had Tracy McGrady, Tayshaun Prince, Richard Hamilton, Chris Wilcox, Rodney Stuckey, and Austin Day, and Ben Wallace. I'll give you some of these excuses. Tracy McGrady had a headache. Tayshaun Prince had an upset stomach. Hamilton and Wilcox just missed the bus from the team hotel. Rodney Stuckey and Austin Day also missed the bus from the team hotel. Ben Wallace was dealing with a family matter, so I guess he was one of the excused parties, but he didn't play last night either. This all stems from, and John Kuster, the head coach, only played six players last night. Doing the waiver, DeJuan Sumners, Greg Monroe, Ben Gordon, Will Byron, and Jason Axill. All the starters played at least 36 minutes. You had three of the starters play over 40 minutes. Jason Maxill came off the bench to play 29 minutes. But this all comes from how John Kuster, who, you know, basically trying to run things with an iron fist, how he's treated one Rip Hamilton. Rip Hamilton, again, when Chauncey Billups left, or was traded, I should say, Rip Hamilton was left as the lone Detroit Piston who carried weight in that locker room. You had Tayshaun Prince, who had a ring as well, but you know, Rip Hamilton was by far and away the most respected person in that locker room. He's been, you know, in the league for a long time now. And again, this goes to how this was dealt with. Rip Hamilton has played once since January 12th. He played in one game. All the other games prior to this one was due to a DNP. Basically, where you had him sitting in warm-ups for 48 minutes doing nothing, you know, biting his fingernails. You know, the trade deadline has come and gone. They were not able to move Hamilton and has a bad contract. Now, maybe 2 years at around $25 million. And, you know, this coach, I mean, you have to be able to handle a situation where, you know, you speak to Hamilton, okay, we're trying to trade you. We're going to sit you. If you argue it out, it's one thing. But the bottom line is, he should have been playing. If you want to cut his minutes, it's one. If you're about to trade him, if you know the deal is going to go through, you know, if he has to play a game or two, that's one thing. That's a whole different deal. You can't sit a guy, basically 20 games, you know, a veteran player, a respected player, a championship player, you know, a guy who's been a leading scorer on a championship team. You can't treat him like that. You know, a lot of these players, unless they hate each other, the majority of these players, you know, are very close. Especially ones who play on each other's team, on the same team. You know, these guys have the same agents. Some of them have the same trainers. They do some of the same charities. So when you tick one of them off, you're basically ticking all of them off. So, again, poorly handled. I don't see how Koester survives this. Now, I'm not excusing it. It's a disgrace to the game of basketball. Those players got to do a better job. You know, you can't miss a team bus. You can't embarrass their organization like that. So, I'm sure they'll be fined and reprimanded and, you know, the whole ball of wax. But Koester really set himself up for something like this to happen. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call, we'll have some React quotes. We'll do the preview of the NL West, and we'll look at the week that was in the NBA in terms of all the trades. Knicks fans, I will get to you. Trust me, I have plenty to say about what transpired over the week with you and Mr. Carmelo Anthony. And we'll talk about that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. 347-215-6180 is your call number. 347-215-6180 is your call number.
This is Surreal Quinn, and you're listening to the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call on Blog Talk Radio.
Minutes after the 10 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn, taking you to 11:30 this morning on this 26th of February 2011. Here we go with some React quotes of the week. I'm a big Blake Griffin fan, but that dunk at the contest might have been the weakest dunk in the dunk contest that I've seen in a long time. That is one ex-NBA player, I don't know what he's doing with himself right now, other than running his mouth, Sean Kemp. The athlete NBA player formerly known as Rain Man. He didn't retire as Rain Man. He retired as a 350-pound pothole when he basically ate himself out of the league. I mean, you know, you see things and you read things, and, you know, normally I would just ignore this, but I need a good laugh. I need a good laugh. Here is Sean Kemp, who at one time in his career, a long, long time ago, had a little Blake Griffin in him in terms of his jumping ability and some of the athletic things that he was able to do on the court. But again, got a $100 million contract, and basically after that ate about $99 million of that contract. And, you know, was never the same. Traded for Vin Baker, you know, tried to, you know, play, you know, bounce around the league for a few years. After that, Cleveland and Portland, and just, again, he ate himself out of the league. I don't know why Sean Kemp is compelled to say anything in general, to even make a comment, let alone talk about the NBA's new golden boy in terms of Blake Griffin. I mean, give me a break here. Sean, listen, don't say anything. Don't even compliment Blake Griffin. Like, no, I want to know the reporter who even would even take time out of his life to listen to anything Sean Kemp has, like, it's relevant. It's comedy to me. I put it on here because it's comedy. But, you know, Sean Kemp, who, you know, would be on a, if there was a sports version of, I can't think of that VH1 show, Where Are They Now? It's not Where Are They Now, but, you know the show I'm talking about if you watch VH1. He would be on there. Or he might, as a matter of fact, he might not even make it to that part, make it to that show. Some of the players are too busy building mansions and doing other things and not concentrating on winning. I have no problem saying that. Hank Steinbrenner, co-chairman, of course, of the New York Yankees. Hank, and we all know who Hank is talking about here. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. He's talking about Derek Jeter, who had a mansion built last offseason in Tampa, Florida, and good for Derek Jeter. I mean, yeah, I think he's earned a couple mansions based on what he's done over the course of his illustrious and Hall of Fame career. You know, I mean, this is typical Steinbrenner. I mean, the apple does not fall far from the tree. Only thing I say to it is, you know, if you have a problem with, you know, what Derek Jeter is doing, how he's spending his time, call him in the office. Why don't you call him in the office and tell him to his face directly? I mean, what's wrong with that? What is Jeter going to do? He's going to quit the team? He's going to walk away from, you know, the $18, $19 million he was making a year? I mean, call him in the office. Or call him by name. You say you have no problem saying that, but you do have a problem with just calling him out by name. Derek Jeter, of course, laughed it all. Hey, yep, Steinbrenner, yep. I'm laughing all the way to the bank as I carry, you know, 5 championship rings, a movie star, you know, on my arm, and, you know, I'm king of New York. So, yep, jokes. So I'm laughing all right. All you can do is you laugh at your Derek Jeter. Because you have to think, it has to make you think about the late George Steinbrenner. Because Steinbrenner, if you don't remember, the late George Steinbrenner criticized Derek Jeter a few years ago. I want to say it was about 7 or 8 years ago, about his partying in New York nightclubs. They did a commercial about it. I believe it was American Express, and, you know, had some fun with it. So, nothing, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same in Yankee land. So the head coach should be aware, but also in the same frame, the head coach obviously cannot be aware of everything that goes on within the program. Dennis Thomas, chairman of the NCAA's Committee on Infractions. This is regarding Jim Calhoun, who was given a, to say the least, a slap on the wrist by only being suspended for the first 3 games of the 2011-2012 Big East season. Calhoun, of course, was fully involved with the illegal recruitment of one Nate Miles, a couple of years ago, a guy who never even said, back in 2008, a guy who never even took the floor and never even put on a UConn uniform. You know, Calhoun You know, they was giving this guy illegal lodging. You know, they sent just extensive amount of text messaging and phone calls that went well over the limit in terms of the NCAA. And they were very fortunate. You know, Connecticut didn't get anything. I mean, they got some probation, some warnings, some, you know, misdemeanors, so to speak. They didn't lose any postseason time. And again, Calhoun, I don't know how a head coach should not be aware of everything that's going on in his program. That's what I thought was the job of the head coach, to know everything that was going on, or close to everything that was going on. And again, Calhoun, the way he pursued this guy, you know, some of the reports that came out, he never pursued a recruit as hard as he recruited this guy. So to me, that statement, you know, a coach not knowing, you know, can't know everything that goes on in the program is a bunch of nonsense to me. And again, Calhoun was very fortunate that Connecticut hasn't been banned from the postseason. They probably should have been banned from the postseason for at least a year or so. Again, they get a minor slap on the wrist. Like, yes, they're going to lose a couple scholarships. They're going to get restrictions on some of their recruiting time, but stuff that their name, Connecticut alone, and Jim Calhoun's name can make up for. He and Bruce Pearl right now just must be living a charmed life, because both of them, Bruce Pearl should be out of a job as far as I'm concerned. So it just goes along with the hypocrisy of college sports. You know, Dez Bryant, you know, talks to Deion Sanders. He gets suspended for the rest of the regular season. They virtually ending his career at Oklahoma State. But coaches can go and, you know, and basically do whatever in terms of legal recruitment and, you know, just get a suspension. I mean, Bruce Pearl gets 8 games this year, from the 8 SEC games this year. Calhoun gets even a lesser suspension going forward into next year. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, I'll preview the NL West, and I will also look at why I have no sympathy for the NBA's small markets. We'll talk about that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. Edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, as we just hit the top of the 11 o'clock hour, 11:03 in the a.m. on this 26th of February 2011. We're going to look at the NL West, the home of the world champion, San Francisco Giants. The Giants coming off the season, of course, where they won the championship, had that great run, where they were just seemingly knocking out star pitcher after star pitcher, going through the Roy Holidays and Cliff Lees of the world. And to me, the Giants come back as clearly the team to beat in this division. It's a decent division, not great division, but pretty good division when you talk about the top three teams. San Francisco, a very interesting move by Bruce Bochy this week, as he's going to make, you know, once you get past Lincecum, he's going to make Jonathan Sanchez is number two starter. He's going to make Jonathan Sanchez his number two starter and have go Lincecum, Sanchez, Kane, Zito, Bumgarner. I thought, you know, that Zito would be fifth and Bumgarner would be fourth, and of course Kane would be second, but he wants to split up the right handers and kind of, you know, try to have some balance to that pitching staff. And it's a great problem to have. Again, this team has some of the best pitching in baseball. I mean, they have, to me, from top to bottom, as far as I'm including that bullpen, I think they do have the best pitching in baseball. And I mean, I'm not, now the Philly starting staff is better, but I would give their edge in terms of their bullpen to the Giants. So I think that they will repeat as NL West champions. I think the key for them is Pablo Sandoval. Can he bounce back from his subpar year? He's lost about 25, 30 pounds. Looks pretty, you know, looks to be in much better shape. So if he can have a big year, he can kind of offset the loss of one Juan Uribe, who went to the Dodgers in the offseason. As far as the Dodgers goes, the Dodgers to me are my surprise team, if you want to call them that, of the NL, of this division. Dodgers went through a lot last year with the whole McCourt situation, divorce proceedings, which still has not concluded. They're still going through that right now. But to me, I like this team going in. I like their pitching staff, especially their starting pitching. They're very deep. You know, Clayton Kershaw is developing into an ace. He's still not a full-blown number one, but he's getting close. Again, they go at least six deep with their pitching staff. Vicente Padilla can be, you can plug him in coming out of the bullpen. I know he's injured right now, but he should be back for the remainder of the regular season. Again, excellent lineup. Ethier was having an MVP season before he was injured last year, and which kind of threw him off for the rest of the season. Kemp, Blake, Casey Blake, Rafael Furcoli, Nov, James Loney, and they added Juan Uribe. I like this Dodgers team. I think the key for them is going to be if Jonathan Broxton can return to the form that made him one of the better closers in the National League a couple of years ago. If he can return to that, then they can threaten. They can definitely threaten to. They can definitely threaten to win that division. As far as the Colorado Rockies goes, the Rockies have a great offense. They're going to score a lot of runs, but again, their pitching staff is suspect to say the least. I mean, outside of Yubaldo Jimenez, nobody on that pitching staff scares me. I mean, I know Chikin is supposed to be up and coming in terms of his talent. He ended the season well, but Aaron Cook, Jorge De La Rosa, Jason Hamill, those guys, you know, they have to show me that they're ready to step up and become decent pitchers. The bullpen is pretty good with Hudson Street and Matt Lidstrom, which is good. It was a nice pickup. You know, Rockies are going to try to outscore people. That's how they're going to win. I don't know if, you know, we all know in baseball that's not the way to do it. So, you know, we'll see what happens with that. But Rockies are a team that can go either way. They can either possibly win a division or they could be, you know, maybe even, you know, in last place. I can see them going in either direction, but I probably see them finishing third in that division. As far as the Padres and Arizona goes, the Padres still have some decent pitching, especially with their bullpen. Latos is close to being a number one. Heath Bell is one of the best closers in baseball. They just lost a ton of talent. I mean, you lose Adrian Gonzalez off an offense that already had trouble scoring. I don't see how they're going to score runs. They're going to be scrappy. We know that they're going to be scrappy in terms of they're not going to be an easy win. But again, they are clearly in rebuilding mode. As is Arizona. Arizona has some nice young talent with Justin Upton, Chris Young, Stephen Drew. When your top two pitchers are Daniel Hudson and Joe Saunders, that should tell you what you need to know about the state of your pitching staff. Hudson is an up and coming pitcher, has a lot of talent. Joe Saunders, coming off a 9-17 season, he's probably on a good team would be a third or fourth starter, and he is their number two starter. So, I mean, there you go with the NL West. Again, to me, baseball is a crazy sport. You never know what's going to happen. Who saw San Diego even challenging for that division last year? And who knows, if they could score some more runs, they would have beat out the Giants to get to the playoffs. But I'm the Giants, to me, though, I don't think they'll repeat. Really, it's almost impossible to repeat in baseball nowadays. The Giants, to me, are just clearly the class of that division. Still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, I will get to the NBA trading, all the trade flurry that went on in the NBA this week, and I will tell you why I would be concerned as a Knicks fan, if I were a Knicks fan. Let me get that correct. If I were a Knicks fan, that's still to come on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll also have a special guest that will join us for the remainder of the program. We will be right back.
You know, I think we'd always considered that could be a possibility. You know, as his contract was winding down, you know, he signed a 3-year contract and said he wanted to keep his options open, and which we respect. You know, and look, I don't have any inclination of if Darren, you know, he never said he wanted to leave. You know, it was never, you know, commitment to say, hey, I really want to stay, but he did talk about that. But, I think really it came down, Ryan, to a risk-reward kind of situation, and we felt like we gave up an awful lot, and we think we got an awful lot. And, I think this is one of those situations where maybe it wasn't a how-to-do. It was more like a want-to-do, and...
So there you go. Saturday morning wake up call. I'm here, Cyril Quinn, taking your tours to 11:30. So that was Kevin O'Connor, the general manager of the Utah Jazz, who pulled the trigger on the Darren Williams trade that sent him to New Jersey in return for Derek Favors, 2 first round picks, and Devin Harris. A want to do versus a have to do. I'm still trying to figure out from a Utah perspective what direction they were going in. It was clear to me that Jersey had to land a big name going to Brooklyn. That was their intention. Now, whether or not Williams signs with Jersey is a whole other story. He certainly has not committed to that as of yet. But from a Utah perspective, Utah goes into this season signing Al Jefferson with the 6th highest payroll in basketball. And now they are pinching pennies. They, you know, getting rid of Darren Williams, having a fear basically of them not being able to re-sign him. And trust me, despite what Kevin O'Connor says, if Darren Williams had indicated to them that he wanted to re-sign there, he would still be on the Utah Jazz right now. So let's be honest about that. I don't know what Utah is doing right now. I mean, Utah is one of the most stable franchises in basketball for the past 20 years. Sloan retires. Now you trade Darren Williams, who is arguably the best point guard in the league, and, you know, for what? I mean, you get back Devin Harris, Derek Favors. I mean, who knows about Derek Favors? Again, draft picks in the NBA, to me, don't mean anything right now, especially considering that you don't have – this is going to be one of the worst drafts probably in the last 10 years in 2011. Again, I don't know what Utah is doing. If I were a Utah fan, I'd be just – I'll be confused about what direction are they going in. You know, who are you rebuilding around? Are you rebuilding around Derek Favors? Again, this is a franchise that is coming, that is about to lose Andre Kirilenko who has an expiring contract of $17 million. So I'm trying to figure out when Utah became the Florida Marlins all of a sudden, in terms of just, you know, drafting stars, rebuilding them, team gets stars get good, then we just trade them away. I missed that part. As far as the big one goes in terms of trades this week, of course, headlined by Carmelo Anthony going to the Knicks. know, Carmelo Anthony, Chauncey Billups goes to the Knicks amongst some other players who were basically throw-ins for Danilo Gallinari, Raymond Felton, Wilson Chandler, Eddie Curry's expiring contract. Listen, this was a clear panic move by the New York Knicks. They did not have to trade to get Anthony right now. They could have waited to the after the offseason, in the offseason, and got him without giving up half their team. You know, and I give the Denver Nuggets and I give Carmelo Anthony all the credit in the world. They played this beautifully. I mean, they played this as well as you could play a situation. Denver used New Jersey Nets as leverage to force the Knicks' hand. Carmelo Anthony used the Knicks' impulsiveness as an organization to force a trade. Again, if you're the New York Knicks, you could have waited to the offseason and got Anthony. Or worse come to worse, you know, let him go. I would have called his bluff. Let him go to New Jersey. Let him go to New Jersey. So you're left with the team you had and the possibility of getting either a Deron Williams, a Chris Paul, or a Dwight Howard in, say, 2012. You know, what's the problem with waiting another season? You waited this long. You stunk for 10 years. They weren't going to be terrible next year with this current team. They weren't going to contend for a championship with this current team. They're not going to contend for a championship with this team they have right now. This idea that Carmelo Anthony is this, you know, superstar player, give me a break. Carmelo Anthony is a pure scorer. Is he an all-star? Yes. But let's not put him, you know, this isn't Miami getting Shaquille O'Neal a few years back. Let's not put him on that LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, Dwayne Wade level. He's not on that level. He's an all-star caliber player who one day will be in the Hall of Fame. He can score with the best of them. But he doesn't do much other than that. I'll say he's a complete offensive player. He doesn't guard. The first time he guards somebody, the next time he guards somebody will be the first. And there were no tears being shed by George Karl with Carmelo Anthony being out of there. Getting out of there. So, again, I think it was a panic move. Isaiah Thomas certainly had something to do with it, his relationship with James Dolan. I don't buy at all that Donnie Walsh wanted this move. I think Donnie Walsh is being the good soldier, saying, yeah, you know, we were all on board. We wanted this. We couldn't have got him. You know, we couldn't have got him in the offseason and so on and so on. It doesn't fool me at all. I think this is an absolute panic move. And, you know, we're going to see the Knicks. The Knicks don't have any flexibility after this season. They're going to have to wait until Chauncey Billups' expiring contract is up in 2012 and then hope that, say, Chris Paul or possibly Deron Williams, if he is not already signed, takes a pay cut to come play there. Because they won't, you know, 2012, they're not going to have a point guard or a center. Remember, you still need to move Amari Stoudemire to the four positions. You're not winning a championship or competing for a championship with Amari Stoudemire as your power forward. Okay, we have a special guest joining us right now. Mark, are you on the line?
Yeah, I got you, Cyril. How are you, man?
Hey, how you doing, Mark? This is, people, this is a very good friend of mine. Go way back in terms of talk radio, you know, back in the old WFAN, not old WFAN days, but the old Mike and the Mad Dog days. He was the producer of the world-famous Mike and the Mad Dog program. Mark Malouse is now, he's doing big things with SNY, still has an overnight show on WFAN. So now he's a celebrity now, so I'm just privileged to be talking to him.
I don't know about all that. That's some buildup, but you know what? I'll take it, you know?
Mark, I know what the fans felt like. You know, I've been reading a lot, you know, in terms of the Carmelo Anthony deal. The fans are going crazy. I have a cousin who is a nuts New York Knicks fan. He's still in a state of euphoria, so to speak. Give me the media's reaction on the deal.
Well, I mean, my reaction was, you know, being a Syracuse guy and watching Melo win, basically help the Orange and carry him on his back at times, help him win a national championship. I mean, I was ecstatic. I mean, I think the guys that they gave up really don't equate or really will never be as impactful as what Carmelo Anthony is. You know, it was a terrible loss last night to the Cavaliers. But to me, you know, I wasn't bashful. I wasn't shy. I mean, if, you know, you're giving up Mozgov, Wilson Chandler, who's not part of the long-term solution, you know, a Danilo Gallinari, a Raymond Felton, who was going to be there for 2 years, to me, the deal made perfect sense. I mean, I think the deal is one that you make every day of the week and twice on Sunday.
So you don't think that they could have waited to the offseason and got him, or they, let's say, you know, for argument's sake, that he would have signed an extension with the Nets, could have waited, you know, to try to get a Dwight Howard or Darren Williams or Chris Paul, you know, going moving forward?
Yeah, but, you know, now, I mean, then you're playing the what-if game. You know, you don't know. You could be left at that point in time with nothing. I mean, if Dwight Howard decides to go someplace else, or, you know, Chris Paul decides to play someplace else, or, you know, and now the Nets have Darren Williams and they convince him to stay in New Jersey. So it's a matter of the what-if game. You know, Amari Stoudemire took on the challenge of coming here to New York. He signed that 5-year, $100 million contract, and, you know, it was all guaranteed, and, you know, he was first step of the process. But then you get back into trying to convince guys to come to Madison Square Garden when there might be other opportunities, not better cities, but opportunities or quicker opportunities in order to go out there and win an NBA title. And now you had an opportunity to get the guy he wanted to be here. Yes, he wanted the money, but I fully believe that, you know, if they did not make that trade for Melo, you know, he wanted the money. He, you know, there's a new CBA. You know, he wants that 3-year, $65 million extension. He got it. I think it's a move you got to make, because you're getting a superstar that's 26 years of age, that's in the prime of his career. To me, it's a no-brainer.
So moving forward, now that, you know, he's on the team, you have him, Billups, Stoudemire, and Langie Fields. That's basically your team. How do the Knicks build after this? And you brought it up, which is a good point, about the new CBA. The salary cap is going to go down. They're talking $43, $44 million. How are they going to add the necessary pieces, you know, to, you know, put them at a championship level? Because, you know, Billups' contract is going to be up after next year, so they'll have some money there. But to me, I look at them as not having a point guard after that and not having a center. I still think, to compete for a championship, that you're going to have to move Stoudemire eventually to the five going forward. So how do you think they're going to build from what they're
doing? You know, I think
now,
number one, they're going to look as far as a point guard down the line. After Billups' career, but his contract does come to an end, and Chauncey has played well in his first two games, but, you know, you get to the old question down the line, you know, you got to see what the number is as far as the CBA is concerned. Is it going to be a hard cap? Is there going to be a franchise tag? I mean, these are all things that are going to be negotiated as far as a new NBA collective bargaining agreement, Cyril. And I look at it and I see a situation where, you know, it might be very, very difficult for the Knicks to add another piece, but, you know, that question can't be answered until we know the particulars of the new collective bargaining agreement. You know, if it's, you know, $45 million, yeah, the Knicks have two players that are locked in at $20 million apiece, it's going to be extremely difficult to add pieces around them. But, you know, you're going to have to be highly creative. But the fact is that we don't know what that answer is going to be. We don't know what the number is going to be down the line. We don't know if it's definitely going to be a hard cap. So if it is, it's going to be difficult. And whoever's running the Knicks, if it's Donnie Walsh, if it's somebody else, they're going to have to be awfully creative.
Yeah, to say the least.
There's no question.
How about the Nets, Mark, and the Nets in Utah deal with Darren Williams? It kind of, like, I was shocked despite all the, you know, despite the fact that, you know, I knew Williams, I thought that Williams, you know, was entering, could opt out of his deal, and there were some whispers that he might not sign with Utah. It still caught me off guard. Are the Nets confident that they can convince him to stay there? Now, you said all the right things the first couple of days, you know, in the first couple of days, didn't give a full commitment, of course. So, I mean, how confident are they that they can get him to an extension and have him moving forward into Brooklyn?
Well, right now, you know, Cyril, right now I don't know how confident they are. I mean, I think they know that they have a year and a half to convince him. I think that's really what it comes down to. They, you know, they've got some time to convince Prokhorov, you know, with Jay-Z, and, you know, Avery Johnson can try and convince him as far as the vision. The Nets had to make that move because they're looking at Darren Williams as a gateway superstar, a guy that can open it up and make the Nets franchise, whether it be in Newark or down the line in Brooklyn, New York, you know, a good place to play. And, you know, even if he doesn't sign, it was a necessary risk because they were not going to be able to convince guys to come to the Nets without that number one bona fide superstar. So, to me, the move makes sense. They gave up, you know, they gave up Harris, who's okay, and you don't know what Favors going to be, a couple first-round draft choices. Those are ifs, not certainties. And I think you look at it now, the Nets are saying to themselves, you know, we got a guy in the fold. We want him to be the face. Let's do everything we can convince him to stick around. You know, maybe be a player for Dwight Howard in the summer of 2012. You know, yeah, you have a young center in a Brook Lopez already, you know, and you know Williams is going to make him a better player. But it was a necessary move for the Nets because they weren't going to convince a free agent to sign there. They needed to have a guy in the fold and be able to work on him for quite some time.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, they had to make the move, and I'm puzzled by what Utah is exactly doing. That's what I'm confused by more than anything. A couple last ones before I let you go here. From a New York perspective, in terms of and to switch gears a little bit, because this has been a big story in New York, I know, with the Mets, and I've been kind of picking up on it for the last couple of days. Are you confident that the Wilpons, are the Wilpons going to be able to hold on to the team? Because it looks to me like as each day passes, it's like looking more and more like they're going to probably try to sell the entire team. Now, I heard 25%, but it's not looking good as far as their future of ownership with Katz and Wilpons. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think right now, I think they're still sticking to the 20 to 25%. I really do. I mean, I don't think they have any interest, even with the report that they took out a loan from Major League Baseball at $25 million. I don't think that they have any interest right now, Cyril, of selling the entire team. I really don't. I think we got to see how that lawsuit by Irving Picard with the Madoff situation does play out, how big of a financial hit they take at that point in time. You know, you read the Times, you read all reports all over the place. The Mets are leveraged and, you know, are in quite a bit of debt. But I think the Wilpons are going to try and find themselves a way out of this. And I think right now their only interest is selling a minority portion of their team. And I don't think they have any interest in selling the entire team. I really don't.
I was thinking about today when I was, you know, reading the articles on it. I don't like the Mets had they had the high payroll. In terms of moves that they might try to make as far as trading deadline, what do you foresee in terms of that? I mean, are they going to be able to make any moves, or what can happen with that?
Well, I have no idea. I mean, you know, I think as far as the trade deadline, I think the moves, you know, right now you look at it, I think it would probably be more like trading guys off, you know, like a Beltran if he shows he's healthy or anything else, and trying to get, you know, continue the building process. I don't think it's going to be a situation where they are, where right now they're going to add payroll come July 31st. I mean, if they're in contention, if all these ifs turn into, you know, solid answers, all these questions you get answered and get answered in a positive way, Cyril, I think then, you know, they could add some. But right now, as it plays out in the National League East, I think the Mets are probably like, you know, the third or fourth best team in the NL East on paper.
Right.
They got to go out there and play
right.
the games. But I think as far as adding payroll, I'm not really sure about that.
Right. Mark, well, I had to let you go. Again, appreciate you coming on, and certainly there's going to be a ton to talk about with you. Big East tournament, March Madness coming up, Yankees and, you know, Mets, the Yankee season should be interesting, to say the least. So we'll definitely get you on over along the way. And, again, enjoy the rest of your day, and I appreciate you coming on there.
Yeah, my pleasure. Anytime, Cyril. Be well, all right, man?
All right. Take it easy.
You got it.
And, of course, Mark Melusis, and, hey, that situation is going to be very interesting with the Wilpons and and Madoff. So we'll see how that happens. That's our show for today. Everybody, enjoy your week. I will see you soon on the latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. So long. Ah.